Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did a painfully shy, buck-toothed kid from the sticks grow up to become one of the wealthiest men in American entertainment, whose name lives on as a household word more than 60 years after his death? As a child, the scrawny and awkward Leroy Robert Ripley seemed an unlikely candidate for fame and fortune, but he used his self-taught gift for drawing to propel himself out of Santa Rosa, California, and into a life of global travel and influence focused on the kind of strange but true tale that would prove a brilliant distraction from the stresses and deprivations of the Great Depression and World War II. Author Neil Thompson tells this remarkable American story in his new book, A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Neil, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be here. Thanks.
How is it possible that yours is the first full-length biography of this man who had such a strong influence ultimately on American media and American culture?
Yeah, I was kind of shocked when I first started this that there wasn't another book out there. I started this project back in 2007, when I came across this New York Times article about a Ripley's Believe It or Not museum that had just opened in Times Square, New York. And the article described in a couple of paragraphs Ripley's life. And I thought, wow, I knew about Ripley cartoons growing up. I guess I sort of knew there was a guy, Ripley. I wonder what his life is about. Went looking for a book and couldn't find one and decided to make up for that omission and spent 5 years researching his life.
He was born in Santa Rosa, California in 1890. Is that right?
That's correct, yep.
What kind of place was it when he was growing up there?
It was a little bit of Wild West at that time, which I think kind of contributed to his later curiosity about certain things. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was kind of an interesting place. It had its own Chinatown. It had attracted kind of an eclectic mix of people, ranchers, winemakers. But it was really just a couple decades past its sort of rough and tumble cowboys and Indians stage. And I think it was sort of a fascinating time and place for Ripley to have grown up.
And Ripley, who was called Roy Ripley by his parents when he was a kid, was physically gifted. He was a good athlete, but he had like this spectacularly unfortunate set of teeth.
Very unfortunate. I probably spend too much time describing them in the book. But you know, they really were this prominent feature. They were unavoidable. I have some childhood pictures of him in the book, and they were almost disfiguring. Mm-hmm. He grew up poor. His family wasn't able to afford anything like dental work for him. So he grew up feeling kind of awkward and as a result shy and felt like a little bit of an oddball. He was mocked in school and treated a little bit differently because he spent so much time by himself. But he had two things eventually going for him. One was his artistic talent, entirely self-taught, and then he became a very gifted athlete, and those two things sort of dovetailed into his career, which started out as a sports cartoonist for newspapers.
Hmm. Within a single year as a teenager, he lost both his father and then his hometown.
Yeah, interestingly enough, he had these, what I call the dual cataclysms of his childhood. His father died of what is presumed to have been a heart attack at a young age. I think he was 50-ish. When Ripley was just a young teenager. And then that was followed 6 months later by the great earthquake of 1906, which, although it's mostly remembered for the devastation it wreaked on San Francisco, it leveled nearly Ripley's hometown of Santa Rosa. It was just had a devastating effect on his hometown.
He did manage to escape injury in that quake.
He did, yep, and I think the family home survived okay with some, you know, some slight damage. I think there were very few houses that weren't damaged to some extent in that town. But it's interesting. He later in life had an appreciation for things like earthquakes and volcanoes and the damage that the earth could do to itself. But he didn't talk much about that event, nor about his father's death. Although you can sort of see signs later in his life of how it might have stuck with him.
He was not especially close to his father, it doesn't seem.
It doesn't seem like it. He again, didn't talk about it later in life, but there were friends who commented on it that it seems as if Ripley didn't think too much of his father.
Okay, so at 18, although later he would sort of mythologize and say it was 14, but at 18 he has his first cartoon published in no less than Life magazine, which is a pretty extraordinary achievement.
It is, and I think that sort of set the stage for him. He realized with that success, it was a panel that he drew of a woman standing at a hand washing machine with the ringers, and the caption said, "The village bell is ringing." And he was paid $8 for that from Life magazine, and I think that was an eye opener. He realized that he could potentially make a living doing what he loved, which is to draw.
Did he actually finish high school?
He did not. He came close, and then I think because of the family situation after his father died and the family ran into financial difficulties, he left and started taking on odd jobs and helping his mom around the house.
Okay, so sports cartoonist. People think about this now and, again, can't imagine it's very useful, but this was a job in high demand before every paper had a robust photography staff.
Yeah, and it was a fun aspect of the story for me because I worked in newspapers for many years, and to learn how important cartoons and cartoonists were in those early days was just fun. You know, at a time before photography was commonplace in the newspaper, talented cartoonists were in high demand. In Ripley's case, he was a sports cartoonist, so his job was to go to a sporting event, draw some portion of it very quickly, and then come back to the paper and finish it up, maybe write a story to accompany it, or his cartoon would accompany it, another reporter's story. But it was this visual retelling of events in what I call sort of newspaper art form.
And he worked in San Francisco first.
Started there, yep, his first job about a year after that cartoon was published in Life magazine. He got a job at the San Francisco Bulletin, lasted there for a little while, and then was fired, in his view, because his art wasn't good enough. He had never been trained as an artist. He was just picked it up on his own and would just practice on his own. So it was after that firing, that losing that first job, that he took his first ever art lessons, which led to another job at the San Francisco Chronicle. He lasted there for about a year before finally taking his talents to New York.
How did those lessons change the way he worked?
You know, I think he was a very diligent worker and disciplined worker. I came across an interesting unpublished manuscript that he wrote describing his artwork and his sort of philosophy on art, in particular newspaper art, because that's what he was, newspaper artist. And he really focused heavily on the body and sort of trying to capture bodies in motion. And he was also diligent about trying to get things perfectly correct. This is jumping ahead to World War I when he was just creating drawings about the battlefield. And he wanted to get the uniforms just right and have everything be, you know, perfect.
Well, yeah, talk about how he began to be a world traveler on assignment.
Yeah, and it's remarkable because he came from this sort of humble profession, which was just sports cartoonist, where he would just go to the stadium and cover a boxing match or a baseball game. But he had this interest in the rest of the world and decided to start pursuing that interest early on. So there's this one key moment I describe in the book where he's moved to New York. He's working for the New York Globe at that time. Again, it's just a sports cartoonist. He's already created the first handful of his Believe It or Not cartoons, which are primarily just about sports feats. Mm-hmm. He takes his sporting job in this direction where he features people doing extreme things in the field of sports. But in 1921, he is sent on this around-the-world trip on behalf of the New York Globe. And that sort of changes everything for him. It opens his eyes to these other parts of the world that he had only heard about or dreamed about. And he starts weaving into his cartoons some of the people and places he sees during his travels.
Why do you think he was drawn not just to the exotic sights he could see in these other places? He went to Europe, he went to Egypt, but to the odd sort of hard to believe phenomena.
You know, I think I argued this in the book. I think some of it had to do with feeling like a bit of an oddball himself. Mm-hmm. Some of it had to do with his quirky hometown, And some of it was just his unique personality, where he had this just insatiable curiosity. It's interesting, when I think about how people perceive Ripley's Believe It or Not today, it sort of tends toward the gruesome side of things. You know, maybe people think of the museums and some of the grotesque things that they have on display at some of those places. And that's, you know, that's interesting to folks. But during his day, Ripley and his view of Believe It or Not and what was unbelievable, it was very broad and more about... I describe him as sort of this ethnographer, an amateur ethnographer or anthropologist. He wanted to know about the extremes of everything, beginning with sports, later the extremes of, for example, what people would do to themselves to prove their religious devotion in a place like India, where he spent some time and was obsessed with. He just wanted to know about all the weird things that happened in the rest of the world. He couldn't get enough of it.
What were his travels like? I mean, how would he sort of plan a trip and hunt down all these things that he could come back and turn into cartoons or later into radio broadcasts and shorts and that sort of thing?
Well, it's interesting. He's someone who probably today would, you know, have an ADHD diagnosis. he would do things on a whim quite often. If he saw an advertisement in the newspaper for some overseas trip to the South Seas, he would pounce on it and you know, drop everything and dive headfirst into this project or adventure. Even on the road, when he was in the midst of some journey, he would change his mind and change plans on a dime. Probably drove his editors crazy. But it was always in pursuit of something that he was curious about. I tell the story in the book about when he was in Jerusalem and sitting in his hotel and reading a passage from the Bible and decides he wants to find the real location of the Garden of Eden, which is in now it's Iraq. And so he goes off in that direction and finds a passage across the Syrian desert in this massive car/truck vehicle, and heads to Baghdad in pursuit of eventually the Garden of Eden. Interestingly enough, he was halfway across the desert and ran into his friend Will Rogers, who was going in the other direction. So that's the sort of a taste of the nature of his travels. I mean, he was very peripatetic and sort of heedless in how he explored the world.
I'm quite sure, Neil, that he did drive his editors crazy, but I guess he was good enough and popular enough that I think I love the account of William Randolph Hearst, like basically picking up the bat phone and saying, "Get me Ripley."
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and it's interesting how that event changed Ripley's life. This is in 1929 when Ripley has just published his first book, sort of compiling a lot of his cartoons and his travel essays and other stories that he's written over the years into this one book that was published by Simon & Schuster. Became an instant bestseller. William Randolph Hearst, powerful newsman of his day, gets an early copy of it and demands of one of his editors, hire Ripley. So Ripley ends up working for the Hearst Machine, in particular for what was called, still exists, King Features Syndicate, which then syndicated his cartoons around the globe. And in no time, he went from being just an average paid journalist hack to a guy who was making $100,000 a year in 1929.
My guest is Neil Thompson. His new book is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert Believe It or Not Ripley. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Neil Thompson. His new book is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert Believe It or Not Ripley. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. By the way, Neil, how did he make the shift from Leroy Ripley to Robert Ripley?
Interesting little side story. When he finally landed in New York after making his way across the country from San Francisco, went there without a job, by the way, just had a little bit of money in his pocket but decided that's where he wanted to work, gets hired at the New York Globe, and one of his early editors says, we can't have a guy named Leroy working on our sports department. It's got to be something else. So he adopts his middle name and goes by Robert L. Ripley from that point forward.
Okay, so we're talking about $100,000 in 1929. You and I are journalists. That's a lot of money today.
Today it is, exactly.
So how did that amount of money start to change his life and his business prospects?
Interestingly, initially it didn't change all that much. At the time, he was living in this tiny two-room apartment in the New York Athletic Club in Manhattan. Kind of this boys club where he was able to indulge his interest in handball and other sports. And he continued to live there for the next few years, I think partly because he was so busy with not only the cartoon, but everything that came after that hiring by William Randolph Hearst. He started getting offers to do lectures, to do early radio programs, eventually offers to do film, little mini film projects that were shown in the theaters before the main feature. So he was suddenly busier than ever, and that busyness prevented him from, moving into bigger digs from the tiny apartment he was in. So I think he didn't initially start spending all that money. It was a little bit later that he finally was able to break free and really start living the large life that that his money from William Randolph Hearst afforded him. We can talk about it, but he bought an island for himself in 1934 and started living in his big 28-room mansion there, where he had a staff of a dozen people running around doing his bidding.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like part Great Gatsby, part Citizen Kane.
Yeah, exactly. And throw in a little Hugh Hefner to boot.
Exactly. Yeah, he gave some pretty colossal parties.
He did. And what I like about him as a person, I mean, there were plenty of flaws, and I discuss them in the book, but he liked to have a good time. He really liked to enjoy life. That was part of his, I think, curiosity about life, as he was curious about other people. He liked to be around other people, hated to be alone. So he threw massive parties, weekend-long parties, where he would have half a steer cooking on a spit for the weekend, and would bring people up and put them up in his guest rooms and have contests and music and dancing. I mean, he just liked to have a great time and enjoy life.
Okay, so we talked about this private island he had. He also had an apartment in New York. These places were furnished in, not surprisingly, I suppose, rather curious ways.
Yeah. He applied his quirky curiosity to just about everything, and in this case, he decorated his homes, multiple homes. Eventually, he had a place in Florida as well, primarily in sort of Asian decor. He was obsessed with China, but Asian slash grotesque, I guess, was the decor.
Not a lot of demand for that among decorators today, Asian grotesque, but... Yeah, I mean, the stuff he collected, shrunken heads and embalmed fetuses and stuff, that was part of the decor.
It was, and it was part of his shtick. I think he liked to shock people as part of the entertainment for him. One of his favorite places in the mansion was the basement bar, where he had all kinds of things scattered on shelves around the bar, including the penis of a whale. So he loved to show that one off to people. Just weird stuff that would make people gasp or laugh or ask questions. He just liked to have fun with it.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about his love life. He was married once, but not for very long.
Yeah, it didn't quite work out, and I think he was not the type to settle down, clearly in the case of his one and only marriage to Ziegfeld Follies dancer named Beatrice. Mm-hmm. They met in 1919. The marriage ended in divorce after 3 years, but really it was over much sooner than that. I think he just wasn't one to want to settle down, and you see signs of that later as he becomes more wealthy, more popular and famous, and he, at his big mansion up in on his island, collects what his friends refer to as a harem of girlfriends. Mm-hmm. These women who would come to work for him in some secretarial role, and before long they would be living on the island with him, then there might be another one living there at the same time, and it was hard for friends to keep track of who was who and who actually worked for him, who was a lover, who was a friend, but he was always surrounded by women.
It's funny, was it just out of decorum that, because it made me laugh reading the book, is like, yeah, he hires another personal assistant, and then there's another one, and they're all young, beautiful things. I mean, was it that it just was unacceptable to say, this is my new girlfriend, she's spending the weekend?
Yeah, I think it was, and he probably didn't want to reveal that he was dating more than one woman at one time. Sometimes they competed against one another. I've found some interesting old letters and documents from Ripley's business manager's wife, who would describe how the women would compete for his attention. They'd all be living there at once, and he'd be going into New York, and they'd basically raise their hand and beg, pick me to go with you. So he lived a complicated personal life as well.
I'm sure he was a fascinating person to hang around, but he was, as we've mentioned, physically, at least from the neck up, rather hard to look at. Were they attracted to his money? Do you have any sense at all of the motivations of the women that were involved with him?
I think based on some of the films I've seen, we discussed his big parties that he would have at his mansion, and I have home movies of some of those events. And it's fun to just see him playing the host. Mm-hmm. He would wear some Chinese robe around for the weekend or some other strange costume. He was always smiling. He was always pouring drinks. I have other people describing how he loved to have toasts. So I think the women in his life probably responded to that he liked to have fun. He liked to show them a good time. And I think even though he wasn't a one woman man, he treated them fairly well. At times, there are episodes we come across later in his life when he's getting into more of a troubled period where he's not so nice to some of the women in his life. But at times, I think they liked being around him because he was just fun, good company.
There was one woman over all these years that seemed to have held a special place in his heart.
Yeah, this would be a woman named Ruth Ross. He nicknamed her Oki. And he described her at one point as the one true love of his life. They traveled together all over the world, in fact. She is another one who started working for him. It seemed as if she began working for him as a translator and then would travel with him on trips. And then they started spending more time together. She was an antiques expert, and she helped him decorate his mansion. She was a little bit older than some of his other girlfriends, but they really seemed to have a great time together. And there was just this one complication with the relationship, and that's that Oki was married.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi. Another great show, as always.
Thank you.
I've been to my only exposure really to Ripley's, believe it or not, world or universe is at the museum in Arlington, which is fairly well known. And the one, believe it or not, of all the things that kind of seemed odd to me, or I wouldn't say creeped me out, but just seemed weird, was the there's a section there, it used to be at least, a section that had a life and crucifixion of Christ. And the presentation of it was almost like, it felt like a passion play, like a Passion of the Christ type play. And I was wondering, leads me to my question, what was his, I don't know if we know much about his religious life, but is there anything you can share about that? Did that have any influence on museum set up and things that were presented in museum? Because it just puzzled me in his presentation of that, that we'd have that at the museum.
Yeah, that's actually a good question, David. He was a very religious person. I'm not sure, I'm not familiar with that specific exhibit, But religion, both his own and the religions of the world, were something that was of great interest to Ripley. And he did spend a lot of time sort of exploring that curiosity about other religions. I mentioned this around the world trip he did in 1921 that kind of opened his eyes to the rest of the world in a large way. And during that trip, he spent some time in India, in particular in this one holy city called Benares, where he would see people expressing their devotion to their god by doing extreme things to their bodies. So Ripley was raised Christian. He went to his mother's church. Interestingly, there's a short side story to his mother's church. It was built out of a single redwood tree, so even his mother's church had its own Believe It or Not, which he featured later on in his cartoon. So he was raised Christian, and he was, I think he had his own faith or his own version of it, but he was also open to and interested in and curious about the world's other religions. He was curious about Muslims and spent a number of cartoons sort of exploring what it meant at that time to be Muslim. He visited Jerusalem a number of times. So I think he was very open to how other people believed, and occasionally he would talk about just religion in general. And I remember there was one speech he gave, I think it was at his church in Mamaroneck, where he said, "Whatever you believe it very much."
Why do you think America was particularly receptive to what Ripley was selling during the period from the 20s through the end of his life in the late 40s?
Yeah, I think he always had sort of timing on his side in an interesting way. During the 1920s, when he began traveling and bringing these travelogues back in newspaper form to American readers, it was during Prohibition. Ripley was a renowned drinker, and so he would write about that in his travelogues and describe what it meant to have a cocktail in Singapore or Panama or, Argentina, almost taunting readers who were under prohibition restrictions back home with his ability to drink at will in other places around the world.
We should say he did plenty of that at home as well.
He did that at home as well, yeah. But it's fun to hear him describe in both his personal journals and in print in the newspaper, finding beer in Baghdad, where it was not supposed to be allowed. He had this knack for finding drink wherever he went. So that's the 1920s. Then you get into the 1930s, where he's suddenly syndicated, thanks to William Randolph Hearst, and his cartoons are appearing everywhere, and it is coinciding with the Great Depression. So it's a time where people can't travel far and wide, clearly can't travel to the places that Ripley is visiting. So he's bringing little odd tidbits of the world back to American readers at this time when, it turns out, they could really use that kind of escapist entertainment. And I think that's why the 30s especially is when he became so successful and popular, is because he gave people what they wanted.
So 1933, the World's Fair is being held in Chicago, and Ripley puts this exhibit he calls an auditorium, O-D-D-itorium, on display at the fair.
Right. So that was the first time he had made this leap to bringing his performers and his strange collections of things to the stage. It was part museum, part, I guess you could say, vaudeville show with a little bit of a sideshow aspect to it. It actually wasn't his idea. It was this interesting character named Cash and Carey. I'm forgetting his last name, but he went by Cash and Carey, who came from Santa Rosa, Ripley's hometown, who was kind of a showman, and helped Ripley put this show together. Ripley was tentative at first. He, up until that point, had only known the world of radio, some lectures, some film and radio, and his cartoons and books, but bringing live presentations was a whole new thing. It was wildly successful. And for some of the same reasons we were just discussing, I think, it was a time when people wanted to have this strange and titillating type of entertainment. So people were lined up out the door at his auditorium during that World's Fair in Chicago, both in 1933, and then there was this encore presentation in 1934.
How important was it to him to establish the provenance of the objects that he showed and to establish that they were indeed genuine?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was something that he battled his whole career to prove the validity of the things he put on display and the things he declared in his cartoons. But I think that's what he loved about the process, was to challenge people to prove him wrong. And in fact, one of the taglines for a while at the bottom of his cartoons was, you know, basically, "I dare you to prove me wrong." And he would encourage people to challenge him. I think he sort of liked that interaction with people. He would make a statement such as Charles Lindbergh being only the 67th man to cross the Atlantic. And he would dare people to prove him wrong because people obviously believed him to be the first man to cross the Atlantic, but he was actually the first man to do it solo. There were others who had done it on dirigibles, and two English aviators who did it in 1919 together. Lindbergh was the first to do it solo. So little tricks like that he loved to challenge people with.
And in fact, he didn't mind if people were up in arms about this because it still meant more attention for him.
Exactly. Yeah, I think he loved that. He loved to be called a liar because he loved to be able to prove himself to be a truth teller.
My guest is author Neil Thompson. We're talking this hour about his new biography. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert Believe It or Not Ripley. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. Maybe you have a memory to share about your experiences with Ripley's Believe It or Not. Maybe you want to ask a question. Either way, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Neil Thompson. His new book is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert Believe It or Not Ripley. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So as you've mentioned or alluded to, Neil, Ripley began to move into radio. Can you tell us about the Ripley and Ozzie and Harriet show?
Yeah, interestingly, he was his sidekick for a while in the early to mid-1930s was Ozzie, of Ozzie and Harriet. At the time, they weren't yet married. Harriet was a singer, and they performed sort of as backup to Ripley in one of his early radio shows. And it's interesting to have explored his radio career because he wasn't a natural, necessarily. He was a stutterer as a kid, and that continued into adulthood, so he wasn't necessarily a natural performer, but I think he had that just can-do and will-do attitude and willed himself to become this radio star who performed at the top of the charts at the height of his fame, along with, you know, he competed against guys like Bing Crosby and Jack Benny, and was contemporaries with folks like Ozzie and Harriet.
What's interesting to me, Neil, is that it seems that even then, it wasn't that people didn't understand that you're supposed to have this sort of golden voice to be on the radio or this beautiful face to be on TV. Even then, they were playing against type in making Ripley his own frontman.
Exactly, yeah. because he clearly wasn't a natural performer, and I describe how he relied pretty heavily on a glass of gin or whiskey before he would have to go on the air to kind of calm his nerves and get him through the show. But I think people really responded to that. I think they saw him as, or heard him in the case of radio, as someone who was like them. He wasn't this disembodied voice. He was, in many ways, even though he came across as awkward, he was also kind of natural. He was somebody you could relate to, somebody who just would tell you a story, as if he was somebody sitting next to you at the bar.
And he was particularly fond of stunt broadcasts from crazy places.
Yeah, another thing that I just love about him, it seems as if everything he did, he wanted to do it in an odd or extreme way. And that applied to his radio shows, where he was not content just to be in the studio in New York. He would want to take his shows on the road and do something sort of clever or extreme. So he did these stunts where he would broadcast from underwater at Marineland in Florida, or from the base of the Grand Canyon, or from beneath Niagara Falls. One infamous show, he had a skydiver jump out of a plane with a mic and a transmitter attached to his harness and attempt to describe his fall over the air. Didn't quite work out as planned because the guy almost died when his main chute failed to open and he had to rely on his backup chute. He survived, but it was wasn't quite the show he was hoping for.
How much did Ripley have to battle, like, network censors and people who said this is really beyond the boundaries of good taste?
You know, I think he pushed it at times. In fact, there was one story that I got during my research where he and his producer/agent were approached by a man who was ill and wanted to commit suicide on the air.
Hmm.
And I think they briefly considered it and decided, okay, NBC probably wouldn't go along with that.
It's also amazing that he died in 1949, but he was already making the transition into television.
Yeah, again, fascinating that he was such a pioneer in so many ways, found ways to turn his Believe It or Not brand into something new, some other form of media every step of the way. Again, not being a very photogenic guy, it was remarkable that he dove headfirst into very early TV. 1949, he launched his first TV show. It didn't last long. In fact, he died during the filming of his 13th episode of that program.
Yeah, such a bizarre... I mean, he had a heart attack. It's not that bizarre, but it's bizarre that it happened sort of while he was there doing the show. What do people remember about that day?
So there were a few different accounts of that day. Unfortunately, there's no surviving footage that I was able to track down. I do have the script of the show and people's recollections. It was a time when he was, I think, suffering physically and emotionally. He was only 59, but he had had some health issues in recent years. His doctors were telling him to slow down, to travel less, to drink less, none of which he did. There was an interesting 1948 trip that he took to China, and this is coming after he was kind of restricted from traveling during World War II, but he was desperate to see China, as he put it at the time, before it fell into communist hands. He was heading in that direction, and he was afraid he would never see China again. So he begged and pleaded his staff and the Hearst organization and NBC to allow him to do this trip to the South Seas, including China, promising that he would do radio programs along the way. He pulled it off. He achieved these kind of remarkable radio broadcasts from places like Hiroshima and from Pearl Harbor, very emotional broadcasts. But people who were with him on that trip noticed a change, this melancholy coming over him, in part because he was witnessing the devastation that was wrought on places like Shanghai during World War II. And I think he came back very sort of heartbroken from some of that, some of what he witnessed. And so into 1949, he's working harder than ever at a time when he's kind of an emotional and physical wreck. I think that's what led to his death.
You mentioned earlier you compared him to an amateur ethnographer. He documented a lot of fascinating things, including, in some cases, abject poverty and suffering. He didn't necessarily have the soul of a philanthropist.
Not necessarily. He did contribute at times during his life. He had an interest in boys' clubs and orphans' groups. He, I think, considered himself an orphan. His dad died, as we discussed, when he was young, and then his mother died when he was about 25. So he contributed here and there, but you're right. There's this interesting piece that he wrote where he described some of the poverty he would witness during his travels, and it would affect him and trouble him, but he would there's one quote, I don't know if I'll get it quite right, but where he says, I'm not ready to reform the world. I can't even reform myself.
Hmm. What was he like to work for?
I think he drove his employees crazy. I think he treated them well when he could, but he was very demanding and someone who, I think, overloaded himself with obligations. He was always late. He was always losing things. Former employees describing the scene at his mansion where they would be scrambling around trying to go from one task to the next, trying to get his radio scripts together to rush into New York City so he could record one of his radio shows. It was sort of this madcap, wacky aspect to the workday up on his island, and it affected his employees. But they were devoted to him, too.
I have to wonder what happened, what it was like going through his homes and his possessions after he died.
For the people who worked for him afterwards?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was a sadness afterwards. So much of the empire was related to Ripley himself and his personality. And then when he died, there was this fear that it would all collapse and disappear. He had a brother who tried to help run the company for a little while, but ended up selling off a lot of the objects and furniture, sold off the big mansion, sold off his Chinese yacht. So little bits and pieces of the empire did kind of just go away, off in all these different directions. But I find it fascinating that the core concept of, believe it or not, of believing in the unbelievable somehow survived without Ripley. And I think it's a testament to whatever it is he tapped into that the brand is with us today, as is, I think, the influence of Ripley himself.
Well, I don't know how old you are. I remember the Jack Palance hosted version of the show that came along in like the 70s and 80s. And there was that kind of like gleeful creepiness that was just so perfect for it, the content.
Right, right. And, that was true to early Ripley. His first TV shows in 49 had something, a similar quality, a little bit more of a Chinese-Asian theme to it, but yeah, a little bit of spookiness to it. But what I like about Ripley is that the things that he thought were unbelievable, it was more than just the creepy, spooky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He was just passionately curious about everything.
What sort of access did you have to, I guess, the archive of his personal papers and his documents and things that ordinary people wouldn't get to see?
Right. No, I was very fortunate to get the cooperation of this company called Ripley Entertainment that now owns or franchises all the museums, still does a cartoon every day, publishes the Ripley's Believe It or Not books every year. They had never cooperated with a writer before. And I think I begged and pleaded just enough to convince them to let me tell Ripley's story, finally, for the first time. And so they agreed to open up their company archives, which is this awesome climate-controlled room at their headquarters in Orlando, Florida, just packed with – it was like a kid in a candy store, packed with everything I could have possibly hoped for. Again, his personal papers, business documents – travel journals, home movies. It was an absolute treasure trove.
Was he particularly introspective in those journals?
No. And that was a difficulty for me because I wanted more of his voice in the book describing what he felt like at certain times. And I came to realize that even if he was alive and I was able to ask him, I don't think I would have gotten that. I don't think that's how he operated. I think we discussed it earlier. He just kind of went from thing to thing and lived in the moment and lived moment to moment, and wasn't one to look back or to get morose. He just wanted to move on to the next thing, and I think that's why that's sort of missing from some of his personal journals.
Did the people that he featured in his cartoons and later in the radio show and even in the TV show, were they compensated in some way?
Yeah, they were. The people who performed in his auditoriums, for example, got a weekly salary. People who came onto his radio show, maybe not early on, but over time would get a small payment. But in a lot of cases, people would have done it for free and probably did at times. I liken it to sort of early YouTube, where people had a strange gift, a quality, an ability, or even in some strange disfigurement, but they wanted to share it somehow with the world.
Yeah.
And Ripley gave that to them, that ability to share themselves with the world.
Well, it is hard to think about YouTube or the internet in general, or certainly reality television, and not think that Robert Ripley had a lot to do with recognizing that we have an appetite for this stuff. Whether we're ashamed of it or not, we're curious.
Yeah, and I think what I liked about him, I think that's very true, and I do make that argument in the book, but I think what he did during his time is showed people that you can appreciate these things, somebody with a disfigurement, somebody with a who's willing to do strange things to their body just for kicks. He taught us to appreciate that with respect. He was never really cynical or mocking about it. He was genuinely awed by the things that people would do, awed by other cultures and other religions. There was a sort of a genuineness to it and a complete lack of cynicism that I really appreciated.
And that's what separates him, I guess, really. He's a planet away from someone like P.T. Barnum.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think he was a champion of the underdog, ultimately, is what it comes down to in my view.
One thing I want to ask you about is this book has, there is sort of a special app designed to augment the hard copy version of the book. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's really fun, and I encourage folks who buy the book to check it out. You would go to, you can find information on my website, which is neilthompson.com, but if you download the app, Android or iPhone, you would search for Ripley's, download the app, and then in the photo section of the book, you scan each page, and that will unlock this extra content. So we have photos of Ripley, some film footage of Ripley, some of his cartoons, just all this fun extra content that you can access with the app.
The new book by author Neil Thompson is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Neil, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Joe Bilotti on the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Lindsay Connect today helped executive producer Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And of course, we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.